Okay, Boker Tov. We're here at Matan, Judaism and the Isms, and we're studying a really important and relevant topic today, which is Judaism and pacifism. Judaism and pacifism. What do you think? Do we believe in pacifism as a religious tradition? Yes or no, or something in between?
No.
No. Everyone says no. No. Does anyone believe? I'm not asking what you think we should believe in. What do we actually believe in?
Well, there are a lot of writers, Jews that are pacifists.
I mean, can you give me any? Give me an example of a Jew who's a pacifist.
The guy in the Jerusalem Post, you'll always.
The guy in the Jerusalem Post. Okay.
What's his name?
Yeah.
He has a column every Shabbat.
Okay, so the Jerusalem Post columnist on Shabbos. Okay, we'll know to stay away from him. Yeah. Okay, who else? Who else in Jewish tradition, I mean, is pacifist? Okay, there's definitely a vision of peace in Sefer Yeshayahu. Okay, Lo Yisad Goy El Goy Cherev. Vision of peace, that's certainly there, for sure. But what? Okay, what's the term that comes to mind with someone like Heschel?
Civil rights.
Civil rights, but something more? I'm looking for something else? Not just civil rights. But,
justice,
but how did they try to achieve civil rights?
Demonstration.
Through demonstration, what do we call that?
Non-violent
protest. Okay. Okay, and it's important you're saying this, Robin, because we have to look at these as two different categories. Pacifism versus nonviolent protest. Yes, Tifa.
Yeah, but I think also Kohelet has said
the time
to...
Ah.
And that
was, is it Kohelet? I thought that was a song by the verse. For every season, turn. Okay, Nachon. Eight shalom, the eight milchama.
Also, along the examples, when
Is pacifism isn't one of them. Very interesting. And what do we call them? Those are different wars. They're different types of war. There's a milchemet mitzvah. Okay, and Milchemet Rishut, which we will get into in just a little bit. Okay, so I want to open this. The first text that I want to say again, Rishut is a war that's not obligatory. Let's say the Jewish nation, once they have their kingdom set up, wants to expand their boundaries. That's not the same thing. Milchemet Mitzvah is like self-defense or conquering the land of Israel itself. Self-defense versus, let's say, expanding borders. Although this also includes conquering the land of Israel. So establishing a national home, okay, and pushing out nations who are idolatrous and immoral who were concerned will influence our society. And then Milchemet Rishut is expanding borders, okay? I want to start with an essay that was written by a letter by Martin Buber, the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, to Mahatma Gandhi. Okay, Gandhi, of course, was the leader of a non-violent protest movement in India. Everyone knows about this. His goal was to undo British colonialism in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. And this is a really, really powerful letter. Gandhi had written, he'd said publicly, to the Jews of Germany, you know, you should just engage in non-violent protests. Okay? That's what Gandhi had said to the world. He also said in regards to establishing a Jewish home in what was then called Palestine, he said, well, Palestine belongs to the Arabs. Okay, so he didn't see that as an option. So he just said, why don't you guys engage in nonviolent protests? Okay, just like, and he made an equivalence between the way Indians were treated in the South African continent, in South Africa at the time, in the 1900s, they weren't treated so well. They were definitely second-class citizens, racism, no doubt. He says, well, it's no different than how you're treated by the Germans. And just like we used civil protest, you should do the same thing to with regards to Nazi Germany. So what's interesting here is that this is Martin Buber, who did not believe believed in ethics, but not in, halakha per se or strict sense of ethics. And he's pretty clear-cut about what he believes about this. This is a fascinating article. You got to read the whole thing. This is written in the 1930s in response to Gandhi. Let's read. Jews are being persecuted, robbed, maltreated, tortured, murdered. And you, Mahatma Gandhi, say that their position in the country where they suffer all of this is an exact parallel to the position of Indians in South Africa at the time you inaugurated your famous force of truth or strength of assault. This is a key phrase. Satyagraha campaign. There, the Indians occupied precisely the same place for the persecution there, also had a religious tinge. There also the Constitution denied equality of rights to the white and black race, including the Asiatics. There also the Indians were assigned to ghettos, and the other disqualifications were at all events, almost of the same type as those of the Jews in Germany. I read and reread these sentences of your article without being able to understand. If I oppose to this the thousands on thousands of Jewish shops destroyed and burned out, you will perhaps answer that the difference is only one of quantity, and that the proceedings were all of almost the same type. But Mahatma, are you not aware of the burning of synagogues and scrolls of the law? Do you know nothing of all the sacred property of the community, some of its great antiquity that has been destroyed in the flames? I am not aware that the Boers, right, an Englishman, in South Africa ever injured in anything sacred to the Indians. I find only one other concrete complaint quoted in that speech, namely that three Indian school teachers who found walking the streets after 9 p.m. contrary to orders were arrested and only acquitted later on. That is the only incident of the kind you bring forward. Now, do you know or do you not know, Mahatma, what a concentration camp is like and what goes on there? Do you know of the torments in the concentration camp, of its methods of slow and quick slaughter? I cannot assume that you know of this, for then this tragicomic utterance of, quote, almost the same type could scarcely have crossed your lips. Indians were despised and despicably treated in South Africa, but they were not deprived of rights, they were not outlawed, they were not hostages to a hoped-for change in the behavior of foreign powers. And do you think perhaps that a Jew in Germany could pronounce a public one single sentence of a speech such as yours without being knocked down? Of what significance is it to point to a certain something in common when such differences are totally overlooked? Okay? Now, the key point here that Buber makes in this article is that nonviolent protest only works if there's a semblance, if there's some consensus of values that you sort of agree with the people who you're oppressing you about. In America, when they were mistreating blacks, asked every American. Yeah, we believe in democracy. Yeah, people are equal before the law. There was an agreement in theory of the fact that every human being is, created in the image of God, and it just wasn't being practiced, and it wasn't being, in practice, they weren't being treated as such. But through nonviolent protest, MLK and others were able to sort of bring out the good in other Americans and show them, like, come on, you know that this is the right thing to do, that we shouldn't be treated any differently than whites, right? And so there was something to, you had another side that you could talk to. There was a conscience in the other person, and you could try to pull that out of them and activate that. Whereas with the Germans, he says, let's go on. It does not seem to me convincing when you base your advice to us to observe Satyagraha in Germany on these similarities of circumstances. In the 5 years I myself spent under the present regime, I observed many instances of genuine Satyagraha among the Jews, instances showing the strength of spirit in which there was no question of bartering the rights or being bowed down, and were neither forced nor cunning reduced to escape the consequence of their behavior. Such actions, however, exerted apparently not the slightest influence on their opponents. All honor indeed to those who displayed such strength of the soul, but I cannot recognize here in a watchword the general behavior of German Jews that might seem suited to exert an influence on the oppressed around the world. An effective stand in the form of nonviolence may be taken against unfeeling human beings in the hope of gradually bringing them to their senses. This is a key sentence. But a diabolical, universal steamroller cannot thus be withstood. So this is not an opportunity for nonviolent protest. The Germans didn't care who protested. They would just kill you or send you to some camp somewhere. And that's indeed what happens. So this is a really fascinating exchange Buber, I mean, rips Gandhi to pieces in this article, in his letter. But what I want to do is I want to actually start with pro-pacifist voices in the Jewish tradition. Okay? To a degree, they're few and far between, but they exist. Okay? And it's worth looking at them and understanding where they're coming from, because sometimes even a perspective that isn't the standard or classical Jewish position can be illuminating and can be an important counter-voice in certain situations to get a more complex thinking of reality. So what I'm going to share with you now is I have a number of quotes here from a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Aaron Shmuel Tamaris, okay, who was a rabbi in Lithuania, born in 1869. He died in 1931. Now, it's critical that he dies in 1931 because this, of course, is before World War II, and we're going to talk about that. But he saw as a little boy a mother, a neighbor of his, a mother, I don't remember what war it is, I don't think it was World War I, maybe it was a Turco-Russian war, whatever it is, a mother, one of his neighbors, she was given the news that her son had been killed as a soldier on the side of the road. And he just saw the pain and suffering that this mother experienced. And this was a young boy, had a great impression on him. And this is what sort of spurred him to start thinking about these things more critically. Now, in his lifetime, he began as an ardent Zionist. He was very Zionistic. Over time, he came to absolutely reject Zionism. Okay? Now, there were many rabbis who rejected Zionism in the 19th century, 1900s, 1930s, 40s, 50s. Many, okay? The Lubavitcher Rebbe at the time rejected Zionism, the Satmar Rebbe, Rav Chaim of Brisk. There were many rabbis who rejected Zionism because they felt...
Most.
We have to wait for the Mashiach to come, okay? That was one perspective. But, he's going to have a different reason to reject Zionism. Okay? We're going to read now a drasha sermon that he gave on Passover. That he gave on Pesach. And he's going to talk about this whole ritual, which we're studying in this week's parasha, of Jews putting the blood of the Korban Pesach on the door. And he's a very interesting reading of this, of Seder, of the Pesach, the Korban Pesach that was given. So let's read this inside. The evil, now let me just explain an important distinction. There's evil for him where a person commits violence, or whatever it is. A person hits someone else and breaks their nose. That's a bad thing. But for him, the worst type of evil is an evil that justifies the institutions of violence and war. Okay? It's an intellectual evil because it rationalizes the most abhorrent behavior. So this is for him the evil that is intellectual. Rav Aaron Shmuel Tamaris, T-A-M. I'll write it on the board.
Okay, Tamaris.
This is from an article written by a colleague by the name of Rabbi David Walkenfeld, who wrote a piece on this particular rabbi and his worldview. The evil that is intellectual, the evil that is lying, the evil that is political, that is to say, evil that brings alongside itself an excuse, is the greatest source of destruction in the world. It is the source of all the disasters and destruction since the time when humanity began in a small way to perfect its intellectual capabilities such as they are. From that time, private murder, the natural murder of an individual falling upon another, has decreased. But in place of that decrease, the lying form of murder has increased. And what does that lie? The formation of nations, which are clubs organized together for the sake of pursuing and afflicting other nations weaker than they are. What is he referring to here? What movement is growing in strength during his time?
Nationalism.
We're French. We're German. This is going to cause an outburst of war in World War I. And Zionism is also influenced by this. This is why he sees Zionism, and we'll see more about this, the seed itself is from a terrible influence of nationalism. Now he's going to explain the Seder Pesach, the Korban Pesach. We can now explain the Braita that discusses the verse, quote, and you shall not leave, not anyone from the door of his home until the morning. Why couldn't the Jews leave their Seder Pesach and go wander in the street, go for a walk, eating a lot of meat? You got to digest a little bit, get some exercise. Why can't they go for a walk in the streets? Rav Yosef taught, once permission was given to the destroyer, he will not differentiate between wicked and righteous. At first glance, this braita is a deep contradiction to the statement of the Haggadah of an eye and not an emissary. This is God saying, I'll kill the Egyptians firstborn and not an emissary. How can the braita say one's permission was given to the destroyer? But according to our ways, the two statements match. For the braita is coming to explain why the Holy Blessed One sought to exact vengeance himself and did not allow the Israelites even to look. God didn't want the Jews to exact vengeance, only he would. The answer is that God acted in this way so as not to arouse a destroyer that is within the Israelites themselves. For once permission is given, he will not distinguish between the wicked and righteous, and the defender will in the end become a pursuer. He's essentially arguing that it would be wicked for the Jewish people to stand up and fight or kill the Egyptians, even though they had oppressed them for hundreds of years. We can see a little bit of difference between the methods of taking one's freedom of the European political powers, parties. Now he's talking about freedom. Okay? So European political parties, how do you achieve freedom? Overthrow the government. Revolution. Okay? Storm the Bastille. Okay? And our way, the Jewish way of achieving freedom, and this is very poignant. They took freedom, for example, during the French Revolution by barricades or by throwing bombs upon some despot or another. And we try to achieve freedom by making a seder, eating matzah, singing hallel. That is to say, by means of repeating well on our lips the memory of the freedom of the Exodus, the godly flame will be fanned within our souls and we remember his kindness and his whole nation and his. A whole nation, just as an individual, must arrange its way of life on the foundation of the aphorism mentioned by the Tosfot. One must be, okay, now he's going to, this is the next paragraph. There's this principle, one must be more concerned about harming others than in being harmed by others. Which character in Tanakh says this, or says something similar?
Yaakov.
We're told about Yaakov when Esav is approaching. Vayira Yaakov me'od vayetzer lo. And Yaakov was very frightened, and he was very distressed. Rashi explains, why was he frightened? That he'd be killed. Why was he distressed? That he would have to kill, that he would have to engage in violence. So he sees this. The Torah is more concerned about harming others than being harmed by others. Indeed, for when a person strives to guard his own fists from causing harm to others, he causes through this the reign of the God of truth and justice over the world, and he gives strength to the kingdom of righteousness. When we refrain from violence, we bring a Kiddush Hashem. The strengthening of righteousness will in turn guard him against being harmed by others. This is not the case if he prioritizes his own self-defense and keeps his fists ready to defend against the attacks of others. He says, better not to defend yourself. You know why? Because then you represent God in the world, peace and shalom. And this is what he's saying to the Jews. We should never engage in violence because then we're like everyone else. We're like these nationalists. We're like these bloody murderers throughout the world. Okay, now I see that this piece was not put in order, but if you go to the bottom text, this should have been earlier. As the text of the Passover Haggadah states, and I shall pass through Egypt on this night, I not an emissary. The Holy One, Blessed One, could have given the Israel the ability to exact revenge on the Egyptians themselves. However, the Holy One, Blessed Be He, did not want to show them how to use their own fists. Even though at that moment it would be to protect themselves from the wicked, it would end up causing the spread of the use of the fist throughout the world, and defenders would eventually become pursuers. Okay, now this is very powerful. There's no doubt that we believe in and agree with this, that violence is cyclical. People who are abused often become abusers themselves. And God is teaching an important lesson, and I've seen this in other sources as well. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, I think, also has a piece about this in his commentary on the Torah and the Yaakov. God was teaching us that just because someone hits you doesn't mean you don't want to become like them. Very often, people who are oppressed, but they overtake their oppressors, but then they just become just like them. You see this in Africa all the time. Fighting in the name of justice, revolution, to fight off oppression, And then the new group, the new tribe becomes a leader, and they're no different than the first crowd. Okay? It's just a cycle of violence. And God wanted this to break this. Yeah.
God will bring this honor and
replace it. Exactly. And they were no less wicked and evil and militaristic. I mean, no less, if not maybe perhaps even more. So we see that this idea of breaking the cycle of violence, I mean, it's very powerful. But the thing is that he takes it to a real extreme, that even self-defense, you're not holding up you're not holding up God's name in the world if you even engage in self-defense. Okay? So he's a real, pacifist. And let's see at the top of page 3, he believes that the universal mission of the Jewish people is to bring about peace by never engaging in violence. If Tamar's word of the universal mission of the Jewish people, the basic idea is this. Jews exist as a people to spread the moral precepts of the Torah, including a pacifist aversion to bloodshed to the rest of humanity. Since an aversion to bloodshed is part and parcel of the moral message of the Torah, the Jewish mission to humanity must be accomplished without the use of force. The suffering of the Jews in exile and attempts to alleviate the suffering must therefore by evaluating in light of the Jews' purpose for existing as a people. Now, so what's the purpose of exile in this world here? The purpose of exile is to exile and accompanying anti-Semitism are not, God forbid, some sort of incitement or pogrom from the Holy One, blessed be He, when we fall behind in offering up taxes in the form of mitzvot. Rather, exile is a necessary result of our destiny and our role. We're supposed to teach the world to be pacifist, that we never raise a hand no matter what the world does to us. Okay, how does he explain Amalek? Good question, I'm not sure. This is, of course, written, he dies in 1931. Could you say the same thing after the Holocaust? That's the fundamental question that one has to ask when reading about this. Okay, now, it is the case that, and let's look at a little bit of history now, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, the Jewish people, the rabbis encouraged a more quietistic, non-political engagement with the world. After the destruction of the Second Beit HaMikdash and Bar Kokhba, which is a real rout by the Romans, we decided, you know what? Trying to be active politically and fight against the Romans and have Jewish sovereignty, it's not working. It's not working so well. And the Jewish people, according to the Midrash, this is a Gemara quoted in Masechet Ketubot, take an oath. And what's the famous oath? The three oaths. What's the famous oath? That they're not shelo ya'alu b'choma. That we're not going to try to, charge onto Israel without the agreement of the nations. And this is the basis for anti-Zionism by rabbis, by Orthodox rabbis in Europe, because they believe we're the Zionists are charging forward and trying to overturn the nations of the world, and we have to wait for Mashiach to come. We have to wait. God will do it for us. So for 2,000 years, we do disavow, for the most part, active, military engagement, okay? Because it didn't work in the time of Rome, okay? And for 2,000 years, it doesn't mean Jews never fought for themselves. They did. Or it doesn't mean they didn't throw a punch if someone threw a punch at them. But we didn't have the opportunity. Sagan? I mean, no, Maccabees preceded this. The Maccabees are during the Second Temple. Mm-hmm. Talking about after the Second Beit HaMikdash already. After the Second Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, and we're in exile, there is an encouragement of don't push for Mashiach to come, don't fight against the Romans, just lay low, okay? The more pacifist approach. Yes?
No, I was just thinking, if you look at history, I mean, we were not the only nation that rebelled against Rome. Okay?
Correct.
I mean, look at Britain, look at France. But we were completely eradicated, erase us from this land. So, when you think about it, if we would have waited...
Well, it's not clear the Romans wanted to eradicate us. They wanted us to be subject to their rule. Wasn't eradicated. It's the Romans. It wasn't eradicated. In fact, listen, the British and the French, I don't know if they rebelled against the Romans. the Romans were trying to conquer their territories, and they sort of, you know, fought back. And if anyone has watched the movie Gladiator or other movies, you see some of these, some of the original war scenes. But the Jews were actually quite crazy for trying to stand up to Rome. I mean, you're talking about, it's sort of like Cuba. I mean, well, Cuba might not be a good example because they have Russian nuclear devices, but it's like Cuba trying to fight America. You know, it's like you have to know who you're standing up against. It was quite bold of the Jewish people to fight against the Romans, and we lost, and we were decimated. Yeah.
200 years the Roman Empire, you know, by itself, you know, imploded.
Yeah, imploded. Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe we would have wasted a few hundred years.
Yeah. And I'm not saying the Romans were good to us, and it was their fault. I mean, they weren't. They were not good to us, but it was a poor calculation in the end. It seems like. Anyway, other examples of pacifism within the Jewish tradition, okay? Let's look at the Meshech Chochma here for a second, okay? This is by a 19th century biblical commentator. I'm just forgetting his name right now. Ramer Simchab Devent, Nachon, thank you. So he says something interesting also about Pesach. He says, and I'll summarize this outside at the beginning. He says, I don't understand. The Jewish people are keeping one day of Pesach in Mitzrayim. One day of Pesach, Chag Pesach. And yet they're already told about the expansion of this holiday, which is going to be 7 days. Chag Pesach, Chag Matzot. He says, why are we doing that? What's the basis for this? So let's read inside. He named the Pesach Mitzrayim. Lo ayachim mutzono hegel yom achad. We didn't have chametz only for one day. Kein katzvu biyom tov lo nahagu. And they didn't even have Yom Tov. Ledati had the Amar lahem ata daber el dorot shel dorot hu laharot shleimut mitzvotav yitbarach. So why did God address the 7-day holiday that would emerge from this? Ki kol ha'amim b'tatotein v'ani musiyot yasu yom nitzachon yom apelat oyim lachag lachug chag nitzachon. The nations of the world, you know what they do? They make celebrations. They have chagim to celebrate victory over their enemies and the destruction of their enemies. Lo kein b'Yisrael. This is not our way. Heima lo yismuchu al mapelat oyveihem. We do not celebrate when our enemies are destroyed. V'lo yachugu b'simcha al zeh. We don't make a simcha. Kemo she'amar, as it says, b'nfol oyvecha al tismach. We don't celebrate when our enemies fall. Okay, continue. Go to the last line here of this first paragraph, second to last line. V'lachin lo nizkar b'Pesach Chag HaMatzot ki bo asav b'Mitzrayim shvatim rak ki yotzeh shev b'Pnei Mitzrayim. We don't celebrate on Pesach. These are the day that we destroyed the Egyptians. No, it's the day that God took us out of Egypt. We emphasize what happened, the positive that happened to us, not the negative that happened to the nations of the world. And therefore, the 7-day holiday is about our leaving, our exiting from Egypt, and not about just the day of destruction. He goes on. He says, you know what else this is true? This is also true with regards to two other chagim. Which other two chagim? Chanukah and Purim. Lekach anes Chanukah. Ein hayom moreh rak al hadakat shemen zayit. Bechinuch bet Hashem v'tarato. On Chanukah we celebrate the lighting of the candles, the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash. Okay. However, and that's why he said that it's specifically 8 days. Because what does the 8 days do? The 8 days remove the focus on the actual victory, the military victory. It spreads it out over this period of celebration of this 8-day miracle. He doesn't quite say, he doesn't say that it was fabricated, the oil miracle. He just says that this was, God specifically did this to move focus away from the military victory. The same thing is true about Nes Purim. We don't say it's the day we destroy them. Rather, Be'amim asher nachu v'hem lo'evehem. The day that we rested from our enemies, that's when we celebrate Purim. Okay, we needed a rest. We don't celebrate the day that we destroy them. We celebrate the day after. Again, moving away from the day. Yeah, what do you think? Yeah, nachon, correct. Also in Pesach itself, we don't recite Hallel at the end of Pesach. because as you know, Kriyat Yam Suf is on the seventh day. We don't say Hallel on the seventh day. We say a shortened Hallel, not a long Hallel. So this is another example of not quite Jewish pacifism, but it's definitely an aversion to bloodshed, an aversion to celebrating military victory and the death of our enemies. And then we have a story which is recounted in two different versions about Rav Chaim of Brisk, who's Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather. Let's see on the left side first. Moriv Rabbi Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik Zal often retold a story about his grandfather, Rav Chaim, who was once traveling on a train and heard some Jews sighing and groaning about the national situation. Suddenly he heard one of them say, "Oi, if only as a result of all these tribulations the Mashiach would come." Rav Chaim went over to him and said, "The Mishnah and Sota lists the number of signs of the Mashiach coming. Spilled Jewish blood is not one of them." Okay, what's the meaning of this story? What's the story saying? Nu, what do you think? What are they saying? They're saying, okay, Mashiach, if people are being killed, must be the signs that Mashiach is coming. Okay? I don't know if there's a militaristic worldview, but one that recognizes that there is going to be death and people are going to be lost and this is part of the world. Whereas he says, no, there's no reason for there to be any bloodshed. It's not pacifist, but it's obviously he's advocating an aversion to violence, certainly not to celebrate it or to try to see any positive in it. There's another version of the story, also that's on the right side here, quoted by Rav Avad Yosef, and this is a tshuva worth mentioning as well. Rav Avad Yosef's argument of lands for peace, right? One could put that on a spectrum. It's not quite pacifist, but it's certainly not, fight war at all costs. Okay, it's a more moderate position. And what happens in this story? Yeah, he says, Rav Chaim says, he says, better that that we push off Mashiach coming than even one soul be killed. Okay? And Rav Avadia says, well, that's the same thing here. Maybe it's better to make peace and give away land than for even one soul to be killed. Okay? So that's where this discussion comes up. But this is a pretty pacifist perspective as well. This is a stronger version of that story. So these are a number of examples of sources which point to a pro-pacifist perspective. Now we're going to go to the anti-pacifist perspective. Okay, anti is probably not the right word. Anti sounds very strong, and we're going to see that our perspective is somewhere in the middle. But let's just share a few different sources here at Halachot. First of all, there's a principle which comes out by the story, The War of Midian, top of page 4. Haba lehorgecha, Hashkem lehorgo. What does that mean? Someone comes to kill you, you get up and kill him first. Self-defense is permitted, api halacha. There's a principle of a rodef. What's a rodef? A rodef is someone who's trying to kill someone else. And what are you allowed to do in such a situation? You can kill the rodef. Eilu hein matzilin otov otan benafshan. Harodef acha chaver lehorgo. If the only way you could save your friend is to kill the rodef, that's what you do. Okay, this comes up in childbirth. Lo aleinu, but there's a situation where the mother's life is at risk because of the baby. So the baby is considered a rodef in this, or the fetus is considered a rodef in this situation. Third case, milchemet mitzvah. We spoke about Muhammad Mitzvah a little bit before with your question. Muhammad Mitzvah, is it Mitzvah? Let's just say it's a war of self-defense. The very notion that you're allowed to engage in war, that it's a Mitzvah to engage in war, you could fight wars on Shabbat as well. That teaches you that we don't just wait, stand by, we're putting our weapons down, do whatever you want to us. No way. We stand up and we fight. Now, there are limitations about when you can fight. There are limitations about how you can fight. And we're going to talk about those. But there's no idea that of total pacifism. And the fourth thing, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Don't stand by idly when your friend is being killed. Okay, you have to step up and protect them. So these are a number of different principles. In fact, the very commandment, which we're going to read in Parashat Yitro very soon, Lo Tirtzach. What does Lo Tirtzach teach us? Don't murder. Don't murder, but what's the Talmud of Diuk that you would pull out of it? Don't murder, but...
Not that I'm not killing.
Don't murder. If you have to kill in certain situations, you do. But you're just not allowed to murder. Okay? That's different. Okay? So let's look at some other perspectives here. Let's first of all look at Rav Soloveitchik here. Kol Dodi Dofek. Has anyone here not read Rav Soloveitchik's Kol Dodi Dofek? Everyone's read it? Well, I'm seeing a few hands here. Okay. Kol Dodi Dofek is a small pamphlet. You could read it in about an hour, 2 hours. This is Rav Soloveitchik after the war in Sinai, 1956, where he shares his view about religious Zionism. It is a seminal text about religious Zionism. He speaks about the six knocks that God is knocking on the door, not knocking on heaven's door, God's knocking on our door, and sending us some very important messages. Okay? And now, the fifth knock, meaning one of the positive things that comes out from this, of the existence of the State of Israel. Now, let me just point out, he's not a messianist. He's not advocating religious Zionism that's messianist. Say we're living in the times of Mashiach. We don't know if we're living in the times of Mashiach. Who knows such things? But that we can say that this is the time of miracles, that we could say. That he's for sure willing to say. It's a little bit more moderate than more minimalist than those who are part of the school of thought of Rav Kook and Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, which believe very strongly, we're living in the time of Geula. He wouldn't use that language. Doesn't mean he doesn't think this is times of Nisim, of miracles, but slightly more moderate perspective. The fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important. For the first time, and this is a stirring speech. I mean, when I read this, you know, I get goosebumps. For the first time in the annals of our exile, divine providence has amazed our enemies with the astounding discovery that Jewish blood is not cheap. If the anti-Semites describe this phenomenon as being an eye for an eye, we will agree with them. If we want to courageously defend our continued national and historical existence, we must, from time to time, interpret the verse of an eye for an eye literally. Wow, that's quite a statement. An eye for an eye means that you know, if someone takes out someone's eye, you have to pay monetary retribution. That's what Torah Shabbat Pet teaches us. Rav Soloveitchik is saying, hey, sometimes we have to interpret it literally and take out an eye of theirs. So many eyes were lost in the course of a bitter exile because we did not repay hurt for hurt. A time has come for us. One second, let me just see if this is still recording. The time has come for us to fulfill the simple meaning of an eye for an eye. Of course, I'm sure everyone recognizes that I'm an adherent to the Oral Law. From my perspective, there's no doubt that the verse refers to monetary restitution as defined by halakha. However, with respect to the Mufti and Nasser, I would demand that we reinterpret the verse in accordance with its literal meaning, the taking of an actual eye, paying no attention to the saccharine suggestions of known assimilations of some Jewish socialists who stand pat in their rebelliousness and think they are living in Bialystok, Brest-Litovsk, and Minsk of the year 1905 and openly declare that revenge is forbidden to the Jewish people in any place, any time, under all circumstances. Vanity of vanities! Revenge is forbidden when it is pointless. But if one is aroused thereby to self-defense, it is the most elementary right of man to take his revenge. Wow. The Torah has taught that man is permitted, indeed, as a sacred obligation to defend himself. With the verse, if a burglar is caught in the act of breaking in, the Torah establishes the halakha that one may defend not only one's life, but his property as well. If the thief who comes to take the property of the householder is capable of killing the householder. Okay, let's skip down. For good reason, the Torah relates that two of its great heroes, The Torah relates that two of its great heroes, Abraham and Moses, took sword in hand to defend their brethren. And when Abraham heard that his kinsman was taken captive, this is Lot, he led forth his retainers, and when Moses saw the Egyptians smite a Jew, he struck down the Egyptian. This behavior does not contradict the principle of loving kindness and compassion. On the contrary, a passive position without self-defense may sometimes lead to the most awesome brutality. Skip down a little bit further to the bold-faced words. His present desire is that the blood of Jewish children who were slain as they recited the 18 benedictions of the daily Amidah prayer shall also be avenged. When God smote the Egyptians, he sought to demonstrate that there will always be accountability for the spilling of Jewish blood. At present, it is necessary not only to convince the dictator of Egypt, Nasser, but the self-righteous Nehru, the Foreign Office in London, and the sanctimonious members of the United Nations that Jewish blood is not cheap. Therefore, how laughable it is when they try to persuade us to rely on the declaration with three great powers guaranteeing the status quo. We all know from experience what value can be attached to the pronouncements of the British Foreign Office and the so-called friendship of certain officials in our State Department. Okay, so he's pretty angry. Last paragraph, skip down to the last paragraph. Let us not forget that the poison of Hitlerite anti-Semitism, which made Jews fair game to all, still permeates this generation, which looked with equanimity upon the horrible scene of the suffocation of millions in gas chambers as a normal event that need not be challenged. The antidote for venom that poisoned minds and dulled hearts is the readiness of the State of Israel to defend the lives of its citizens. Listen, my beloved Knox. Very powerful stuff. Okay? Now, he's not advocating violence for the sake of violence. He's advocating even revenge for the sake of self-defense. This is the right of man. This is the most basic right of man. Let's move on to a piece here by Rabbi Michael Broyd. Rabbi Broyd is a professor of law at Emory Law School in Atlanta, Georgia, a great scholar. He has a short article on this. Difficult as it is in our society, current society, to take a stand against pacifism as a societal or individual moral philosophy, it is clear that the Jewish tradition does not favor pacifism as a value superior to all other values or incorporate it as a basic moral doctrine within Judaism. Judaism clearly has accepted a practical form of pacifism as appropriate in the right circumstances. For example, the Talmud recounts that in response to the persecutions of the second century, the Jewish people agreed, literally took an oath, that mandated pacifism in the process of seeking political independence or autonomy for the Jewish state. This action is explained by noting that frequently pacifism is the best response to total political defeat. He says we do embrace pacifism. You know when we embrace pacifism? We have no choice. Because if you don't embrace pacifism, you'll just be destroyed. It's not an ideal. It's used as a strategy when there's no better option. But it's not an ideal like Rabbi Tamaris suggested, that this is the ultimate destiny of the Jewish people, to be pacifists, to bring God into the world through pacifism. No. This is sometimes being pacifist. Sometimes, you know, if a burglar, you know, breaks into a home and he's surrounded by 12 cops with guns pointed at him, if he decides to shoot, he's not quite pacifism. He wants to live, so he puts his gun down. And that's what the Jewish people did for many generations, and had to do for many generations. So too, okay, so this is, we're going to skip now to the, let's skip down to Professor Yehuda Mirsky. Now he brings a few examples, a few interesting examples of nonviolent protest. Okay? And sort of pacifistic sort of, you know, examples of pacifism. But these are not, again, he shares the same perspective as Broyd. These are not examples of pacifism as an ideal. This is just a strategy of pacifism in order to live. It's a form of survival. Okay? And but first he's going to say that, you know, a big part of Judaism is the continuation of the Jewish people, that we should continue to exist. And that in and of itself demands sometimes a military response, or demands, you know, standing up against violence. Because how else are the Jewish people going to continue to exist? So let's see this inside. First, Judaism's conception of humanity's place in the world is fundamentally activist, committed to the establishment of a just and godly social order here on earth, and through worldly means. Just as you mentioned, Professor Yehuda Mirsky is a professor at Brandeis University. The institutions of this world of Olam Hazeh, including war and statecraft, are good or evil depending on the uses to which they are put. Clearly, the Old Testament sees the use of force as a legitimate exercise in certain circumstances. Indeed, the Sixth Commandment, which I mentioned this point, Lo Tirtach, though usually translated as Thou Shalt Not Kill, is more accurately rendered as Thou Shalt Not Murder, implying ab initio a notion of legitimate use of force that pervades the biblical corpus. Might does not make right, not by right nor by power, but my spirit, says the Lord of Hosts. But, eight milchama, there is a time for war as there is a time for peace. Okay, the thrust of the Judaic law of war is to accept war as more or less a given in the life of nations. This is a reality. You can't deny reality. But to hem it tightly with moral restrictions at every step of the way. That's how we fight war. We have war, we accept this as reality, but sometimes we send down noise bombs so that fewer civilians are going to be killed. Sometimes we put in phone calls. This is what Israel does today. Sometimes we don't attack a certain building or a certain group of people because there are civilians around. I saw Fauda, one of the shows of Fauda, and in one of the scenes, you know, they could have killed a terrorist, and there's a drone overlooking it, and they decide not to attack. It would have killed too many civilians. These are very complex situations. I don't envy any soldier or any general who has to sit and decide what to do in these situations. It's always easier after the fact to say, oh, they should have done that. They should have done that. But, you know, it's much easier in hindsight to know what to do. And this is why I'm very proud of our Tzvah Hagana Yisrael, of Tzahal, which I believe is the most moral army in the history of the world. There is not an army on the face of the earth that comes close to the standards that Tzahal takes in terms of trying to prevent civilians from dying. And it's not a simple issue. I mean, one can make the case, as some do, that, well, if we'd be a little bit more aggressive sometimes, we would lose fewer lives on our side, and we might be more effective in winning wars. And there's a strong case to be made for this. It's a very complex issue. The Jewish tradition has what to say about it. Although we haven't discussed these things actively for the last 2,000 years until, more recently the last 70 or 80 years or so. But there's no doubt these are very complex issues, and there's a case to be made that sometimes Israel is sometimes a little bit too sensitive. And, okay. So this is Professor Yehuda Mirsky. Let's go to the next page. And he brings another example of non-violent protests. One of them he felt was martyrdom in the 12th, 11th, 13th century. If you remember, Hasidei Ashkenaz, the Jewish community in Ashkenaz, these are the children and grandchildren of Rashi. They lived through the Crusades, and instead of converting to Christianity, or being forced to convert, what did they do? Many of them decided to engage in martyrdom. Okay? Rav Yehuda HaChassid writes about this, I mean the Balei Tosfot wrote about this. There were whole communities which decided to take their lives instead of worship, Christianity. And this was obviously debated in halachic literature. Maybe one should die at the stake. One should be killed by non-Jews, but should one take their life ahead of time? This is discussed in halachic literature. The consensus seems to be that you don't have to do that, but if you choose to, it's permitted to do this. Okay, this was the explanation given. Just look at the... Masada is an earlier example. Nachon, Masada is another example. But he sees this as a form of protest, of nonviolent protest, or nonviolent resistance. Another example that he sees, if you go to page 7, okay, is how the Jews behaved in the Holocaust. Has anyone encountered the Tshuvot Mima'amakim, written by Rav Ephraim Oshri? Rav Ephraim Oshri was a Rav in the Kovno ghetto in World War II, and people came to him with all different types of questions. Terrible questions. I remember one tshuva that I looked at recently, a child who's 9 or 10 years old says, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to wear tefillin. I don't know if I'm going to make it to my bar mitzvah. Can I put on tefillin now? Oh, beautiful. Can you imagine the questions people had to ask? And every Yom HaShoah, I do comparative tshuvot. I compare something that came from the Holocaust, the tshuva from the Holocaust, and then one from Medinat Yisrael on the same topic. And to just compare, it helps us to recognize, wow, how privileged we are to live in this time period. But, you know, you analyze a particular issue. And so this is one that I looked at. The key point here is that he sees this, Mursky sees this as an example of nonviolent protest. Adhering to halakha even under the toughest circumstances. Saying we're not going to let the Nazis own us. We're not going to allow them to push us away from our tradition. We're going to maintain total commitment to halakha even under the most pressing barbaric circumstances. Okay? And that's an example of nonviolent protest. Again, we believe that we have to stand up and fight. But it's the last option. It's not the first option. When we try to do everything else that we can to not engage into... Now, the example in terms of the Nazis, as we spoke about, the Jews had no chance of standing up to the Nazis. It wasn't... The Nazis were a huge, massive war machine. There wasn't an opportunity here. But we did engage in nonviolent protest through adherence to halakha. And there were many Jews who were in the partisans. There were many Jews who fled to Israel to fight for Israel, again, to make a place, a homeland for the Jewish people to run to during the Holocaust. Now we get to what I think is a very interesting piece. And with this we'll conclude. This is a... So we talk about peace, the pursuit of peace. Land for peace. There's a line in Bakesh Shalom V'Radfehu. You should seek peace, run after peace. Now what does that mean in practice? What does that mean in terms of how we should engage in war and statecraft? Now I want to share with you a theory put forth by Robert Aumann. Anybody know who Robert Aumann is? Robert Aumann is won the Nobel Peace Prize, in economics. Not for peace, but for economics. I'm fairly certain, he wrote about game theory, okay, research game theory. I just want to confirm this, but I'm fairly certain this comes from his speech that he gave at the United Nations. At the Nobel Prize, ceremony, okay? And I think this is the website, I'm fairly certain it's the website that I took it from, but I do have to check again. And, it was a much longer speech where he talks about game theory. But one of the points that he makes is that we have to look at war rationally. Okay? How do you prevent war? How do you bring about peace in the world? And in this speech, he actually quotes from our prophets, from Yeshayahu. It's really, what a Kiddush Hashem. So now let's get back to war and how Homo economicus, rational man, fits into the picture. An example, bottom of page 7. In the spirit of the previous item is this. You want to prevent war? To do that, obviously you should disarm. Lower the level of armaments, right? No, wrong. You might want to do the exact opposite. In the long years of the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, what prevented hot war was that bombers carrying nuclear weapons were in the air 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Disarming would have led to war. The bottom line is, again, that we should start studying war from all viewpoints for its own sake. Try to understand what makes it happen, pure basic science. That may lead eventually to peace. The piecemeal case-based approach has not worked too well up to now. Okay, so he's arguing, let's study this through game theory. Let's study this scientifically. And you'll see that the way to prevent war is to prepare for war. Prepare for war, and you prevent war. Put your arms down and you invite war. Unfortunately, we are all too aware of this in the Middle East. Okay? We leave Lebanon, Hezbollah arms even further. We leave Gaza, Hamas arms themselves. Okay? So, nachon. I don't want to get into politics, but unfortunately, history has a lot to teach us about this. We end with a passage from the prophet Isaiah. V'haya ba'acharit hayamim nachon yiyeh har beit Hashem b'rosh haharim v'nisa migvaot v'naru elav kol hagoyim v'halchu yamim rabin v'amru lechu v'na'le el har Hashem el beit Elokai. Not sure what the end word here, but at the end of days, Jews, non-Jews will be streaming, and by the way, if you're not going to keep this copy, give it to me. I notice that Shem Hashem is here, okay? So we have to put this in Geniza. The people will be streaming towards Yerushalayim. Streaming towards Yerushalayim, which will be, that will, a place people want to get close and go there. And we'll see, if you're reading Midrachav, look at the right side of the Midrachav, Ki Mitzion Teite Torah Devar Hashem Yerushalayim. We will, from Torah will go forth from Zion, and it goes on this very beautiful vision, V'chetetuch Avrotam Le'itim, a sword will turn into plowshare, V'chani Tonetayim Amazmerot, Le'isa Goyel Goy Charev, there will no longer be any war. Okay? There's an English translation here below. Isaiah is saying, go to the top of page 8, that all nations, the nations can beat their swords into plowshares when there is a central government, a lord recognized by all. In the absence of that, one can perhaps have peace. No nation lifting up its sword against another. But the swords must continue to be there. They cannot be beaten into plowshares, and the nations must continue to learn war in order not to fight. Okay, so really sort of ironic twist here. And we'll conclude also with Buber. This is also from the letter he wrote to Gandhi. We began to settle again in the land 35 years before the shadow of the British gun was cast upon it. We did not seek the shadow. It appeared and remained here to guard British interests and not ours. We do not want force. But after the resolutions of Delhi at the beginning of March 1922, you yourself, Mahatma Gandhi, wrote, quote, have I not repeatedly said that I would have India become free even by violence rather than that she should remain in bondage? This was a very important pronouncement on your part. You asserted thereby that nonviolence is for you a faith and not a political principle, and that desire for the freedom of India is even stronger in you than your faith. Meaning, you'd prefer that India be made free by violence if there's no other option. And for this, I love you. Wait, you know, let me make sure I got this right. I would have India become free even by violence rather than that she's remaining. Okay, fine. And for this I love you. We do not want force. We have not proclaimed as the Jesus, the son of our people, and as you do, the teaching of nonviolence because we believe that a man must sometimes use force to save himself or even more his children. But from time immemorial we have proclaimed the teachings of justice and peace. We have taught and we have learned that peace is the aim of all the world and that justice is the way to attain it. Thus we cannot desire to use force. No one who counts himself in the ranks of Israel can desire to use force. But, as he already said, it is at times necessary. So with this we conclude Judaism and pacifism. Please God, we should live in a world where there is no war, where there's no need to bear arms. Le'isa goyel goy chayrev should come true. Kim mitzion teitei tzara. But in the meantime, we unfortunately have to do what needs to be done to defend Am Yisrael. Yisher Koch, everybody, pleasure learning with you. We will continue.